I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Streets turn to violent rivers, houses flood, even in desert areas. Social media is filled with apocalyptic scenes of extreme rainfall this year. In the first week of September, Hong Kong recorded its heaviest hourly rainfall on record, with 158 millimeters, that's 6.2 inches, between 11 p.m. and midnight. Epic rains fell in Spain, Greece, Turkey, Bulgaria, Brazil, and oh yes, Burning Man. But is it all due to global warming? Andrew King is senior lecturer in climate science at the University of Melbourne. He says climate change isn't always to blame for extreme rainfall. Andrew led a new paper in Nature Geoscience to explore what is and is not happening here. From Melbourne, Australia, Andrew King, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on, Alex.
Why did you and your Australian colleagues investigate the drivers of extreme rains and floods and how we talk about them?
Well, it's important for us to understand the role of climate change in different types of extreme weather events. There's a tendency these days for us to kind of automatically link any kind of extreme weather to climate change. But we know, of course, that before we were influencing the atmosphere through our greenhouse gas emissions, we were already seeing extreme weather events. It's not always climate change that's to blame. For heat extremes, we have a really clear trend. We know that human-caused climate change is exacerbating heat waves across the world, both on land and in the ocean. But for extreme rain events, it's a much more complicated link.
Talk to us about the nasty floods in eastern Australia in 2022. What happened there?
So we saw really heavy rainfall and bad flooding actually repeatedly over the last few years in Australia. Ever since kind of late 2020, we've had generally quite wet conditions across Australia. Not so much the last few months, but we had 2 to 3 years where it was consistently quite wet. And we had some really very wet spells, including in early 2022, when we had really exceptional rainfall and lots of records broken along the east coast of Australia. So really around Sydney and Brisbane particularly. So we saw very heavy rainfall over several days and very severe flooding that did result in fatalities and lots of infrastructure damage, very high insurance costs. And this was not long before a federal election in Australia. So there was great interest in this event and the government's response to this event, but also the government's action on climate change.
And did you end up concluding that that flooding was due mainly to climate change or due to other causes?
So with this event, we determined it's most likely due to other causes, really. We had a La Nina at the same time and during La Nina events. So La Nina is when we have colder than normal ocean conditions in the central and eastern Pacific and warmer than normal conditions in the West Pacific. And because the warmer than normal sea temperatures are nearer Australia, that means there's kind of the conditions for rainfall to occur more easily in eastern Australia. So there's more moisture in the air and more frequent low pressure systems. We typically see wetter than normal conditions during La Niñas in Australia. And we think that that was the main driver. But also we had quite a bit of bad luck. I think we had weather systems that kind of stalled over eastern Australia and basically caused persistent rain for several days. And we don't think that climate change is really, well, we don't fully understand the climate change effect on those weather system patterns. Climate change probably played a small role in the event, but it wasn't a primary driver by any means.
Well, that's interesting because for years we've been given the maxim that for every degree of warming, the atmosphere can hold about 7% more moisture. And that's a huge amount of water transferred from the ocean or the land or the ice fields up into the sky. How can that extra load of airborne water not be a factor in pretty well every extreme rain event?
So we have different types of extreme rain events. We have extreme rain that occurs over an hour or two that causes flash flooding, and we have extreme rain events that last many hours or days and tends to cause river flooding. So the kind of more persistent heavy rain causes longer term or larger scale floods. And certainly the effect of warming the atmosphere and it being able to hold more moisture is really important. We know that this is the case, and we can observe, especially for short duration extreme rain events, that this is a really important effect in intensifying those kind of torrential downpours. So when we have, over most of the planet, we see intensification of extreme rain events on timescales of minutes and hours. But for extreme rainfall that occurs over several days, the biggest factor is having weather systems in place for a very long time that deliver extreme rainfall. The other part of the ingredient for extreme rainfall beyond the moisture is having low pressure, having rising air that has to condense and precipitate out rainfall. And we don't really fully understand the climate change effect on these weather systems. We think it's regionally variable. So in some parts of the world, we think climate change is intensifying these low-pressure systems and making them more frequent. But in eastern Australia, if anything, we might think that they're slightly decreasing in occurrence. So that means we might have kind of two contrasting effects, where climate change is increasing the amount of moisture available to be precipitated out, but might be decreasing kind of the propensity of the air to actually rise and cause extreme rain in some parts of the world. And this is really important for these kind of longer duration extreme rain events like we saw in eastern Australia last year.
Well, this reminds me, too, of storms like Hurricane Harvey in 2017. It just sort of sat over Texas and rained for days. And we can contrast that with a recent event here in North America. Hurricane Idalia roared over Florida in the southeast, and there were big storm surges, there were heavy winds, but there wasn't a lot of flooding. And I think that's because it moves so fast compared to storms like Harvey. So are we talking about the ability to rain, but then we're also talking about the speed of the weather system that's involved?
Absolutely. Yeah, but when weather systems move on very quickly, we tend to see shorter-term floods, and maybe not as bad flooding. But when we have weather systems that stall over a region, you can get really bad flooding. And indeed, that is what happened with Hurricane Harvey. With the Hurricane Harvey event, which saw really bad flooding over Houston in Texas, we do think that climate change exacerbated that event. So there have been studies that have explored this event, and it does look like climate change increased the amount of precipitation from Hurricane Harvey. But in other cases, it's less clear, especially for the kind of mid-latitude low-pressure systems that affect regions a bit further away from the equator. And their persistence is kind of a bit harder to see a climate change signal in many areas.
Andrew, can you talk to us about one of your new 2023 papers, Climate Change Emergence Over People's Lifetimes? It sounds intriguing. What's it about?
So that paper is quite different from looking at extreme rainfall. This was about looking at warming that has occurred over people's lifetimes across the planet. So we can look at, well, kind of how perceptible warming has been over different parts of the world for different people. And generally, the longer someone has been alive, the more likely they are to have seen a clear signal of climate change, of local warming over their lifetimes. So generally, we see that the clearest warming occurs over equatorial regions for a given period of time. So if we look at, say, the last 50 years or the last 100 years, and we look at how clear is the local warming trend relative to just the variability in the climate, we see a really clear warming trend over tropical regions. But if we actually look at people's life experiences, because it tends to be that people in mid to high latitude areas are a bit older. So these are regions of the global north particularly. That's in contrast to in equatorial regions, which are typically in the global south, and we see much younger population demographics. The actual perceptibility of warming is roughly even between these different populations because it's a younger population in tropical regions and an older population in mid to high latitude regions, typically.
That's kind of strange in a way. I mean, you would think that older people would really realize the climate has changed, but I don't see a lot of climate acceptance in North America, for example. It's hard to say, but then you take a country like Iran or any in the Middle East where more than half the population are below the age of 25. They're really young, so they haven't experienced perhaps as much, but then again, it's been record hot in Iran. I guess they do know something's happening. It's very confusing how we would apply this on a social level and understand who does and doesn't understand climate change.
Indeed. Yeah, this is something I'm interested in, but I'm not a social scientist at all and probably need to work with a social scientist on this. I mean, we know that younger people generally are more concerned about climate change, and it might be more to do with education rather than experience. So older people, you know, during their schooling were less likely to hear about climate change because it was less of a problem, you know, a few decades ago, whereas younger people tend to be more aware of the problem of climate change. I think that might be kind of overriding this general issue of different experiences of climate change.
That makes sense. You know, you can have disasters in Australia, and Americans, Canadians, we don't hear very much about it. I long for media to become truly global because I don't see how we can tackle issues like climate until the public feels we are all part of one planet. Your thoughts about that?
I completely agree. And I would say, I would kind of go a bit further than that and say that we really don't hear much about extreme weather events in the global south, typically. At least in Australia, we're more likely to hear about extreme weather events in North America or Europe than we are to hear about the ones that affect parts of Africa or South or East Asia. And we know, in general, that the impacts of extreme weather events are very different in different parts of the world. When we have a hurricane affecting the U.S., we typically don't see that many fatalities, but we see really large economic costs. When we have a tropical cyclone affecting a less developed region of the world, there's much more fatalities usually, many more fatalities, and lower economic damage. So I find it quite alarming how little we hear about extreme weather events that can kill hundreds of people in the global south. You know, they have huge impacts. And this is on regions of the world which are less resilient to extreme weather, less able to adapt and, you know, respond to extreme weather events. Yeah, the impacts are really much worse overall in these regions, but we don't hear about them.
Although that can change somewhat. I notice India's record on dealing with extreme weather events. They have really reduced the death rates, and Bangladesh has been doing not too bad too, but in general, I totally hear what you're saying. We're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Mainly that we're in the middle of a bit of a crisis in that we have record high greenhouse gas emissions globally. So we're warming the planet at a record high rate. And even though there's all this talk about reaching net zero emissions and decarbonizing, greening our economy and society, we're a long way from doing that yet. We need to rapidly turn this around if we're going to tackle, really kind of limit global warming and reduce the impacts of climate change generally. So the next 2 or 3 decades are really, really critical, and we need to see really rapid changes.
From the University of Melbourne, we've been speaking with Dr. Andrew King, Senior Lecturer in Climate Science. You can find links to the news and science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for sharing your time with us.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Perhaps you were not listening to Radio EcoShock in early 2006. I'm going to replay my quick report on killer smog. It is just as true today. This will also prepare you for an upcoming program asking the question, if we clean it up, will that add to more warming and triggering tipping points? Is it too late for clean air?
A report from Radio EcoShock.
I think you're all aware that asthma rates in children have increased dramatically in recent years. There's been a reported doubling in incidence rates in the last 20 years. And a recent study confirmed that 25% of elementary school children in Harlem had asthma. And developmental problems have also been increasing, even accounting for improved diagnosis. Rates of learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism have increased, and an estimated 15% of elementary or school children in the U.S. have at least one learning disability.
That's right. Classrooms full of wheezing kids with inhalers in their pockets. Postmodern kids have damaged DNA and diminished IQ because chemicals are hitting them right in the womb in their earliest stages of development. Okay, this is last year's news, but the horror of industrial damage to our new generation of humans hasn't really reached us. We definitely don't want to hear that our air, seeming so clear, is poisonous. And our vehicles, those magic things that let us fly across the ground, reach right into the womb and our lungs ever after. A team of researchers led by Dr. Frederica Pereira has proven this with a groundbreaking study in New York City. The team from Columbia University followed hundreds of mothers from the first discovery of pregnancy through infancy and early childhood. One of the most important discoveries? Pesticides and other industrial chemicals are mixing with car exhaust, a kind of unseen toxic smog that penetrates the womb and harms humans at every stage of life. Pesticides cause birth defects, damage DNA, and predispose children to diseases later in life, especially cancer. We know this by science and by the sick and dying people exposed to pesticides. Of course, you don't use pesticides, just Mother Nature brand soap in your home, so you're okay, right? Not really. As Dr. Pereira describes in a 40-minute speech given to congressional staffers, pesticides are everywhere. Blood tests of random citizens, whether in Europe or North America, reveal 60 or more toxic chemicals running around in all of us. Trust me, you're getting your fair share of the chemical feast.
I've got mercury, lead, arsenic. I've got flame retardants. I've got the stain repellent. I've got PCBs. I've got pesticides. I've got insecticides. So, you know, digesting that and then thinking, well, these are carcinogens, these are toxins that are in me, and then thinking that we only tested for 88. So I have to just extrapolate that and think there are hundreds more in me, and there are hundreds more in everybody. You burst the bubble of denial pretty quickly.
The biggest non-surprise? Automobile smog combined with pesticides and stress form a super threat to human health. The exhaust of cars and trucks, which we all take for granted, is so powerful it crosses nature's protective barrier in the womb, the placenta, and injures our babies. The number of cars and trucks has more than doubled since the 1950s. We are producing a new damaged generation, the exhausted ones. Let's introduce Dr. Frederica Pereira from the Mailman School of Public Health, Columbia University. A stylish-looking woman, Dr. Pereira, known as Ricky to her friends, has that rare combination of vision and science and the skills to attract public agencies and dollars for the study of disadvantaged people. She argues it is far cheaper, not to mention more humane, to prevent diseases from the moment of conception than to pay for many lives of illness and disability. Exposure to pollutants caused chiefly by vehicles was measured by backpack air monitors worn by the women during the third trimester of pregnancy. When the babies were born, genetic alterations were measured. Researchers found an increase of about 50% in the level of persistent genetic abnormalities among infants with high levels of exposure, said the study's senior author, Dr. Frederica P. Pereira, director of the Columbia Center for Children's Environmental Health. Quote, "We already knew that air pollutants significantly reduced fetal growth, but this is the first time we've seen evidence that they can change chromosomes in utero," Dr. Pereira said, adding that the kind of genetic changes that occurred had been linked in other studies to increased risk of cancer. Well, those three paragraphs in the New York Times note that vehicle exhaust is altering the genes of newborns and a whole generation, and not in a good way. It's a shame that car pollution stories don't warrant the full-page spreads available to car makers and oil company advertisers. But Dr. Pereira said much more in a talk titled Prenatal Exposures to Pollutants and Future Health Risks. It was part of a policymaker education course for congressional staff, organized by the Harvard Medical School Center for Health and the Global Environment. It was on March 30, 2005. 25% of inner-city kids with asthma? Autism and other birth defects spiraling. 15% of school kids with a learning disability. In the 1950s, when cars were just beginning, these things were rare. Now they're common and growing. Everyone and every teacher knows a family with a child with difficulties. These problems are worst for visible minorities who enjoy the dense traffic and truck or bus yards built into their already burdened neighborhoods. But who doesn't live near a highway now? Who doesn't inhabit an airshed loaded with vehicle exhaust? In a criminal oversimplification of the doctor's speech, she emphasizes three major causes of genetic deformation and disease in the womb and childhood. Pesticides, vehicle exhaust, and stress stand out from a complex weave of possible causes, once obvious things like tobacco, alcohol abuse, and heavy metals like lead are factored out. The study found that stress of living in pollution feeds the terrible stress of trying to raise sick or mentally challenged kids. It's a negative feedback loop. Cars and trucks produce many chemical combinations, but gasoline and oil are basically hydrocarbons. When they are burned, they emit particles called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. That chemical name is too long, so we use the acronym PAHs. PAHs can occur in nature when organic matter burns, perhaps in a forest fire, but that's nothing like the persistent flood of airborne PAHs produced by our transportation system. There are many types of PAHs, and some of them are highly carcinogenic, cancer-causing, and mutagenic, creating mutations of DNA even in the womb. PAHs are found in all sorts of petrochemicals like solvents and dyes, as well as burnt gasoline. Roofing tar, creosote, and coal-fired power plants are strong sources of PAHs. So are cigarettes. But today, we're just focusing on vehicle exhaust.
For the PAHs, they are known carcinogens, developmental toxicants, and I'm referring to in experimental animals and or humans. And now there's beginning to be evidence that they also contribute to the causation of asthma. That is, prenatal exposures can contribute.
Breaking more new ground, this New York study tested the combination of chemicals in the real world as opposed to the standard government tests of individual chemicals by themselves.
We were quite ambitious in this research, and we're attempting to document exposures to all of these and to look at the effects of each one singly and then also in combination, because the real world, of course, is that you get exposed to all of these things. And previous studies have looked at one particular exposure at a time.
This is vital. Governments and chemical makers carefully isolate one chemical and test it on rats. They base the safety level, the amount you may be receiving, on this illusory system. In reality, all sorts of chemicals appear in untested combinations. We inhale and ingest a chemical smorgasbord that has never been tested on humans by anybody. We're all part of this global experiment to see what happens to human biology. Welcome to the experiment. Babies and kids are far more sensitive to environmental toxins than adults. The doctor explains why.
Now back to the this key issue that I can't hammer home enough. It is this heightened susceptibility in the developing fetus and young child. For many pollutants, at these life stages, the individual has differentially higher exposure. For the fetus, there's greater absorption and retention of certain toxicants, and that's true for the child as well. For the young child who is eating a great deal more food, ingesting a lot more food and water on a body weight basis than an adult, any pollutants in those, in the food and water, will also be ingested by that developing child. And then, of course, mouthing objects, crawling, that's another vector for exposure in the young child. So there's greater exposure, absorption, retention, but also the systems that we have operating in we adults have operating at varying efficiencies, but much better than in the fetus and child. To detoxify chemicals and repair the damage they do to DNA are immature and not efficient in this early developmental period. And then the higher rate of cell proliferation puts cells, DNA, genes at risk and offers the potential for disruption in normal differentiation and growth. And then, of course, for carcinogens, there's just a lot more time for cancer to develop if the cancer is initiated as early as in utero. So there is concern about this window of exposure and susceptibility, and imagine what the preventive benefits could be if we could really take steps to protect this very sensitive period.
So in the Bronx and in Harlem, the team set up indoor air quality monitors and occasionally fitted the pregnant mothers with backpacks that measured pollution. That was all combined with blood tests, questionnaires, and a host of other measurement techniques. They followed up with health checks on the babies and followed the kids up to school age so far, all the while comparing the amount of pollution with the actual health of the children, both mental and physical. Science is proving that exposure to pollution sets up prenatal changes that can determine major diseases in childhood or even much later in life. The study doesn't just measure what toxins remain in the body, it shows the genetic damage caused by pollution.
This is a marker of genetic damage from, say, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, where the chemical has actually hit the DNA and latched onto it, and you can measure those fingerprints.
Chromosomes are damaged, immune systems compromised from birth by pollution. It's visible at a microscopic level, not a theory, but a provable fact. They studied the lives of 700 mothers. They found PAHs and pesticides in every air sample, in every breath they took.
And what we have found so far, I mean, I'm just going to give you a few highlights. The fetus is exposed to multiple toxicants. Air monitoring and questionnaire indicate that every single air sample taken during pregnancy, therefore every mother and every fetus, had prenatal exposure to PAHs and pesticides in air. And the levels did vary, and they appear to vary as a function of proximity of residents to major roadways, heavily trafficked roadways.
The fingerprints of DNA damage from PAHs was found in 40% of newborn babies. Organophosphate pesticides like diazinon were found in 100% of the babies. Doesn't the placenta, the blood barrier in the mother's womb, protect the unborn child?
Does the placenta provide any kind of barrier to large chemicals?
Yes, it does. The placenta is intended to do that, and it does do that. It reduces, it's been estimated from experimental studies that it reduces the level of PAHs, for example, by a factor of 10. And yet, I'll show you some findings that we have that suggest that even despite that protection, the fetus being more sensitive, less able to detoxify, repair damage, actually has as much or more DNA damage than the mother.
These pollutants also reduce birth weight, meaning more chance of illness or even reduced IQ in later life. Again, PAHs from auto exhaust and other carbon burners is now proven to reduce the survival of human offspring. New York City spends $450 million a year for their early intervention programs, trying to help the victims of pollution. The cost of treating asthma in American children in 2002 was $7 billion. Of course, many of the growing number of children with asthma in China or Poland don't get treatment at all. Add more billions of dollars for the productivity loss resulting from a drop in IQ, a generation less smart, less able to solve the problems that polluted their young bloodstreams. These are powerful economic arguments to reduce urban pollution.
Until all of a sudden, you feel like someone's choking you, or an elephant sitting on your chest.
This report is from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Radio